This is Jeff Spittler, March 5th, 2000, A Tale of Two Kingdoms, Part 16. The Regency of Wharton, Part 1. Okay, I thought we'd start off with, let's see. Oh, an announcement. In 2 weeks from now, I'll be out of the country, so no class 2 weeks from now. Next week, though, we'll have class. Yeah. I'm going to go research Scottish church history, so. I mean, you wouldn't want me to teach this class without doing first-hand research, would you? Field trip. Anybody who wants to go with me, just see me after class. We'll go on a field trip. We'll see some Scottish church history. Okay, so last week, we just to review a little bit, we saw the rise of the so-called Tolchin bishops. Right, these are the ones that emulated the calf skin stuff, the straw, which caused the cow to give milk. For the lords got the benefices and presented such a man as would be content with the least commodity, and set the rest and infused tax pensions to them or theirs. Okay, Knox. He died in our coverage last week. As we recall, near the end, this didn't get on the tape, and I know Mike wanted to make sure that it was recorded for posterity. He had a steady stream of visitors. He opened a new hogshead of wine and encouraged his guests to drink heartily, as he told them that he knew he would not finish it. So, and it was good to the last drop, according to Mike. Okay.
He wasn't a listener.
Not that we know of, no.
May I ask a question? How can the RPC LA Church have such a problem with wine drinking when the founders of its roof seem to readily enjoy it?
Okay, so the question is, at the beginning, how could the RPCNA have had a problem with the drinking of alcoholic beverages for so long, although that's been partly remediated now, not completely, but that's a good question. Maybe I'd rather answer that later, but I think it goes back to the last century in the suffrage, not the suffrage movement. It goes to the suffrage movement. It goes to the temperance movement. Well, I said suffrage. That was a slip of some sort. But no, it was the temperance movement of the last century. And as one of our elders pointed out to me, that God doesn't just drop denominations out of the skies. They have history. It's history we're studying here. And our own denomination has some history after the 16th century that we're studying now. So, anyways, well, we could discuss that later, but I think it goes back to the temperance movement as far as I know. So, okay, on the 26th of November, Knox is buried in the St. Giles Churchyard. His grave is now purported to be in a parking lot. That was at least by the guard that we asked when we were there with the carols in 1997. And the newly elected regent, Morton, was quoted as saying, "There lies he who never feared the face of man." And it's like a pretty good summary. But I thought we might take a little bit to review Knox's life and his influence, how he's been treated by history. His 19th century biographer, Thomas McCree, who was quoted from often, points out that Knox possessed strong natural talents, that although he didn't have access to the very finest education when he was younger, he surmounted this disadvantage. You might recall that he taught himself Hebrew while on the continent. He was extremely zealous for the faith, as we've already noted, or seen many times. He was an excellent preacher. While he was loathed by the licentious and profane, he got along very well with his brethren in the ministry. On the negative side, he was occasionally subject to some melancholy or depression. He sometimes confessed that he was a bit churlish and begged forgiveness for that. His zeal occasionally led him to use intemperate language, and to quote McCree, his inflexible adherence to his opinions inclined to obstinacy, and his independence of mind occasionally assumed the appearance of haughtiness and disdain. And we might also add that we have often noted his sense of humor in the writing of the history of the Reformation. I'd meant to also, I guess I had this in my mind to cover, but I've left it out of my notes. It's interesting. Knox is was reputed to be an excellent preacher. He left behind very little in the way of sermons, just one, and that one he had to recount for a reason. Okay, and I guess I didn't even bring it with me. I was going to give Knox, there's a little quote he gave someone at one time why he didn't leave written sermons. He just didn't feel that was his calling. He didn't leave very much in the way of commentaries, on biblical passages, exegesis, and so on, even though he did it. I think it was McCree that also pointed out that by this time in the Reformation that there had already been quite a bit of fundamental material written and available, and so there maybe wasn't the need for it that there had been a few years before. Okay, McCree also discussed that God had fitted Knox for the task at hand, and quote him, to those who complain that they are disappointed not finding in our national reformer courteous manners and a winning address, we may say in the language of the Lord, of our Lord to the Jews concerning the Baptist, John the Baptist, what went ye out into the wilderness for to see, a man clothed in soft raiment? Behold, they which are gorgeously apparelled and live delicately are in king's courts. But what went ye out for to see, a prophet? Yea, I say unto you, and more than a prophet. Skipping ahead a little bit, he says, disaffection to the work often lurks under cavils against the instruments by which it is carried on. And had Knox been softer and more yielding in his temper, he would have been pronounced unfit for his office by the very persons who now censure his harshness and severity. Before the Reformation, superstition, shielded by ignorance and armed with power, governed with gigantic sway. Men of mild spirits and of a gentle manner would have been unfit for taking the field against this enemy, as a dwarf or a child for encountering a giant. So, I think that's probably true, that God in history has often used various kinds of men. Sometimes they've been extremely robust and aggressive and so on, and Knox sort of fit that mold, but he was sort of also uniquely fitted for the task at hand. Knox's treatment in history varies quite a bit. You might expect, Roman Catholic writers, especially contemporary ones, who were writing propaganda, treated him terribly. They ascribed all kind of wickedness to him, including witchcraft, fornication, and so on. But he's also been treated very poorly by the other kind of excuse me for inventing a word, but Mariolater. Okay, so Roman Catholics, of course, have worship Mary, and the other kind of Mariolater is those extreme partisans of Mary, Queen of Scots. And this is again to quote McCree, but the greatest torrent of abuse poured upon his character has proceeded from those literary champions who have come forward to avenge the wrongs and vindicate the innocence of the peerless and immaculate Mary, Queen of Scots. Having conjured up in their imagination the image of an ideal goddess, they have sacrificed to the object of their adoration all the characters which, in that age, were most estimable for learning, patriotism, integrity, and religion. So this is definitely true. I mean, true that those who've been sort of looked very favorably on Mary Queen of Scots have condemned Knox for a number of things, mainly the way he treated Mary. But it's also been pointed out by the Earl of Moray's biographer, Maurice Lee, as far as I know, the only biographer, that most of the treatment of Moray had depended primarily on what the writer's opinion was of Mary, Queen of Scots. So if the writer was favorable to Mary, Queen of Scots, and they portrayed, then they made up their mind about Moray, And likewise, if they disliked her, then, you know, he usually got much better treatment. Okay, more modern treatments. They follow to some degree what we've just, you know, mentioned. So if you read, like, Antonia Fraser's biography of Mary, Queen of Scots, she's definitely a partisan. Although she did mention, called other people partisans of Mary, Queen of Scots, so I guess she might maybe think she's more neutral. She definitely portrays him as an egotistical, self-important, sour, killjoy, and according to her, it was unlucky for Mary that Knox lived in Edinburgh, quote, to act as a demoniac chorus for all her actions, which, good or bad, he presented in the most malevolent light. This is a little sample there. A more recent secular biographer of Knox, Jasper Ridley, his interesting biography, this was written in the 60s, he sees Knox primarily as a successful revolutionary. And you'll see, I think there's probably a side to which this is correct and a side to which it's just bizarre. But to quote him, he says, Knox is one of the most ruthless and successful revolutionary leaders in history. He was more ruthless, at least in theory, than any revolutionary of more recent times. But Knox and his Puritans are the only modern revolutionaries who proclaim that it was sinful not to kill their enemies. Now, this is, I mean, to my way of thinking, this is a bit disingenuous. The number of Knox's enemies that were killed was so small, you know, it was extremely small. I mean, even in the Scottish Civil Wars that preceded the Revolution, or the establishment of the Reformation, right, there were very few people killed. And then, aside from that, there were, you know, we've talked about most of the, you know, things that happened. There just wasn't, you know, that's why he says in theory. I mean, if we compare to any recent revolutionary activity like, you know, the gulags in the Soviet Union or Cambodia or something, it's far removed from that. Ridley, let's see, he attributes the fact that the Protestant Reformation in Scotland became Presbyterian to Knox, and that's became Presbyterian rather than Anglican. And then he says, Knox is one of the most important theorists of modern times. His importance has been overlooked because of the language in which he expressed his ideas. But when Knox wrote about the punishments inflicted on Pharaoh's soldiers for their docile compliance with orders, and the zeal of Jehu in killing wicked kings, he was putting forward ideas that were far more important in the future than the politico-legal theories of government of Bodine and Sir Thomas Smith and the intellectuals of his age. Only Buchanan can equal Knox in importance. Okay, this duty of the individual to resist evil rulers was taken up by the English Puritans, partly through Milton, his tracts that he published, and let's see, quoting again, through Milton, Knox, influenced by example, if not by doctrine, the men of 1776 and 1789, whose outlook has shaped all subsequent political thought and action. And again, I can sort of agree with Ridley on 1776, that the American, quote, revolution, you know, was partly influenced by these ideas, but I'm very skeptical about 1789, the French Revolution, being influenced. I mean, Ridley is a secular biographer, but he seems to completely miss this, you know, this concept of rule by God's law versus rule by autonomous law. And, you know, the French Revolution was completely autonomous, and, you know, so to claim that Knox influenced the French Revolution, I find a little hard to stomach. But here's the piece de resistance from Ridley. Okay, speaking of how the, quote, duty of obedience to kings was cracked by Knox, he says, because of this, Knox, despite his intolerance, his dogmatic adherence to every word of Scripture, and the tyranny of church sessions, was a great contributor to the struggle for human freedom. He taught the people they had a duty to fight for the right, irrespective of national allegiance and the orders of their governments. Modern democracy is grounded upon this principle, which Knox deduced from the text of Exodus and the Book of Kings. So I think, for a secular biographer, that's pretty high praise. But, of course, he sees it as all being despite of Knox's religious opinions. But the last sentence is probably pretty good. He It's grounded upon that principle. Okay, well, I thought it might be worthwhile just to kind of look to see how history has treated Knox. I always find it interesting when you read about someone historically, you'd also like to know, you know, if you're reading, say, one perspective, the Presbyterian perspective, it might be interesting to know how other people have treated him. Okay, let's see, by now, 1572, James VI was 6 years old. He was receiving a classical and Calvinist education under the tutelage of George Buchanan. So this is the foremost man of letters in Scotland, and he's tutoring the king. Unfortunately, in the end, the education had quite the opposite effect intended. Okay, so instead of ruling as a reformed magistrate, James was perfectly trained to undermine the reformed church. He was a prodigy. He's very bright, I guess naturally very bright, and he also had this, you know, excellent education, but he was also very rebellious and demonstrated amply his depraved nature. McCree makes this comment that he attributes part of the problem with James to the fact that Buchanan, although Buchanan was his tutor, he also had an under-tutor. The under-tutor was a much younger man. He fawned on the king, and he thinks he actually encouraged his bad attributes and so on. So while a king should be treated as a boy while he is one, this other tutor would tend to undermine what Buchanan taught by, you know, he'd always kneel and kiss James's hand when he came in, you know, and all this stuff that basically went to his head. Okay, but Buchanan, as time went on, became more and more aware of James's nature, and I think you may find this entertaining. If I can find it. Okay. Buchanan had written a play called Baptistes. It was written in Latin, but it was a play about John the Baptist. But supposedly, well, first of all, in Portugal, it almost cost him his life with the Inquisition. He had told them then that it was referring, I think, to Henry VIII. Can't remember who else. But the theme of the play was tyranny, and he inscribed it for James. He said, "This little book must seem to have a peculiar interest for yourself, inasmuch as it sets before you in the clearest manner what torments and miseries tyrants endure, even when they appear to be most prosperous. And this lesson I deem not merely beneficial, but absolutely necessary for you." Okay. He paused and looked, frowning into space, and then continued. "Moreover, I wish my book to be a standing witness to posterity that not with your teachers, but yourself rested the fault." Okay, so this is the dedication he wrote into the book. And this is Otto Scott. "No clearer warning to the realm or to the future could have been composed, but Buchanan decided that this warning was not enough." And so he went on actually to write another book on this, which we'll probably talk about next week, about the rules for kings of the rule of law for kings of Scotland, and that it's probably that book why Ridley said, you know, besides Knox, only Buchanan was as influential. It's this book that he went on to write, I believe, published about 1578. Yes.
If these men were tutors, who was raising him in other respects?
He, let's see, I think he lived with the Earl of Mar. He lived with one of the noble families of Scotland. And I think it was the Earl of Mar's family. He, they raised him in his household. And, you know, that apparently wasn't unusual, even if his parents were sitting on the throne, although, of course, he was a semi-orphan with his mother. His father blowed up, and his mother off in a prison in England. So, okay, well, as we mentioned last week, the Earl of Morton has become regent, And he was described by Maurice Lee as a man of high political skill and no morals whatever. So shortly, within 6 months of becoming regent, in May of 1573, he forced the castle at Edinburgh, which was still being held by the Queen's party, to surrender. The Lethington of Maitland of Lethington, the Queen's advisor, you know, former, he worked for a while with the Reformation, but he was reputed to be an atheist. He committed suicide, or apparently committed suicide. The other defender of the castle, Kirk Caldy of Grange, was actually one who had been a Protestant, and in fact Knox had once sent an emissary while he was in the castle to warn him that he should desist from his actions. And supposedly this led to the story after Knox's death, that Knox had said that if he didn't desist that he would be hung with his face to the sun. And supposedly when he was, after he came out of the castle, they tried him. There was some thought of leniency, but then letters were discovered where he had communicated both with Mary and with Alva, a Spanish general in the Netherlands, about bringing troops in. And so they hung him. And supposedly when he was hung, his body slowly turned on the scaffold and until he was facing the sun. I don't, you know, it's just an interesting story, but... So... Okay, with Knox gone, Morton apparently felt more free to bend the church to his will. Morton corresponded closely with Elizabeth, and Hetherington, a 19th-century Scottish historian, believed that he was following Elizabeth's example and trying to make the church more like the Anglican Church so that he could control the bishops, quote, till it should become as prelatic and as accommodating as that of England. He did try to place bishops who would probably, if they were really in a leadership role, would have corrupted the church. Let's see, again, this is another quote from Hetherington. But not content with his Tulchin bishops, he endeavored further to impoverish the church that he might thereby both enrich himself, a matter which he never neglected, and at the same time induce its poverty, if it's not its will, to consent to the pernicious measures. He contrived to draw in his own hands the thirds of the benefices, offering more sure and ready payment to the ministers than had been made previously by their own collectors, and promising to make the stipend of each minister local and payable in the parish where he labored. But no sooner had he obtained the thirds into his own hands than he joined two, three, or even four parishes together, appointing to them by means of his obedient creatures, the Tulchin bishops, but one minister who was obliged to preach to them by turns, Morton paying him as if he had but one charge and retaining the remaining stipends for his own purposes. So, it's, I don't know, whereas other people will meet up with who oppose the Church of Scotland, probably do it partly for ideological reasons and so on, it would seem, from what I've read of Morton, that it was primarily financial with him. So, the church continued to struggle against the interference. They, let's see, in the summer of 1574, they, in addition to remonstrating with him, they censured one of his bishops for improper conduct. And about the same time, Andrew Melville returned to Scotland. Okay, so who was Andrew Melville? Well, first of all, he's the author of the quote that the class takes its name from, right? The this quote to, you know, he was speaking to James the First when James is older than he is right now about how there are two kings and two kingdoms in Scotland. That was Andrew Melville. He was born the 1st of August, 1545. His father was killed at the Battle of Pinkie. That's the name of it. And that was a battle with the English. So I think that corresponds to Henry's rough wooing, but I may not have the time exactly correct. Okay, his mother died either the same year when he was 12 years old, depending on which historian you read, but I think probably the same year. Because the rest of the story is that he was raised by his older brother, Richard Melville, and his sister-in-law, and they treated him basically very well, and they were able to give him a first-class education. Richard Melville himself had studied at Lutheran universities on the continent, and by the time that Melville went to St. Mary's College, at St. Andrews, the University of St. Andrews, 1559, okay, so he was, what, 14 then? he was already able to read Greek. So, and if you'll recall, I mean, Greek wasn't even taught in Scotland until just about, you know, just maybe just prior to his education. So he learned from someone who had been brought from the continent, you know, to teach in the 1550s. Okay, when he was 19 in 1564, he graduated from St. Andrews. He'd learned everything that he could there. He went to the continent. He studied at the Royal Trilingual College of the, which is part of the University of Paris, and he studied languages and philosophy there. 2 years later, he went to the University of Poitiers. He was made a regent in the College of St. Marcion. He studied law there for 3 years. And then with civil war going on in France, in fact, he was tutoring someone who was killed by a cannonball. And he went, fled to Geneva. And while there, he, Beza, Theodore Beza, Calvin's successor, put him forward for the chair of humanity at the Academy in Geneva. And he did that, and he also continued to study while he was there. He published some poetry. I'm not really sure about his literary output besides that, but he was apparently well known for his literature. Certainly well known in Scotland. He received a number of letters imploring him to come back, and he was finally persuaded to return. He arrived back in July of 1574. When he got there, the regent, you know, already knew about him, and he, you know, as the regent was trying to appoint sort of his men to the bishoprics, he offered him a position in his household as a, quote, domestic instructor, with the sort of carrot that he promised him when a better position was available, read archbishopric or bishopric, that he would appoint him to that. Okay, Morton had no interest in higher education himself, but he was trying to influence the church by installing bishops that he had control over. Well, Melville demurred, and instead he went to the University of Glasgow, which had sort of fallen into a, quote, ruined state. With the Reformation, a number of the Roman Catholic professors left, and the university needed some revitalization. So he was appointed its head, the principal, and the university was granted a benefice, okay, which came with some income, but it also came with the responsibility of the principal to preach in the local kirk. So for 3 years, he was this minister of this church of Govan, I guess it's in Glasgow, I don't know exactly where. Okay, he was also a doctor, which is, you know, as we discussed before, an ecclesiastical office in the kirk. Right, and I did a little more reading on this. You know, you could, depending on your view, some people looked at doctors as sort of teaching elders as opposed to preaching elders. They were elders. That would be the view of George Gillespie and James Guthrie. Or he might be thought of as a specialized pastor minister, and that was the view of Samuel Rutherford. So, in any case, doctor was a class of elder. So, because of that, Melville became very active in the Church of Scotland, and he was soon appointed to several committees by the General Assembly. Okay, so the church continued its struggle against episcopacy. Okay, and it's not yet wholehearted, but in that they're still asking some questions about it, but now with the aid of Melville's formidable intellectual power. Okay, so in March 1575, they passed an act requiring everyone appointed a benefice to know Latin, right, so that they make sure they're not completely uneducated. The regent, apparently frustrated with the church, asked if they would follow the Leith Concordat, and this was this agreement by which they, the Leith Concordat, 1572, and that was this agreement by which they would appoint bishops, or but the king could actually suggest who the bishops were, and they had to be men, you know, they had to be examined by the church, but, you know, if you read their oath, they were clearly the king's man. So he basically said, well, if you can't follow that, why don't settle upon the form of the government by which you will abide, or a form of, you know, church government. So, They didn't meet, well, shortly thereafter they appointed a committee which looked at that, but let's see, in August 1575, John Dury, an Edinburgh minister, protested that their examination of a bishop's conduct shouldn't imply that the office was lawful, and that led to further debate that wasn't answered conclusively yet. In the meantime, Morton offered Melville a benefice, and then he offered him the Archbishopric of St. Andrews. Okay, in April 1576, they started to resolve the question of bishops, and they made the following statement, that the name of bishop is common to all who are appointed to take charge of a particular flock, in preaching the word, administering sacraments, and exercising discipline with the consent of their elders, that this is their chief function according to the word of God. Okay, this statement, even though maybe this doesn't answer all questions, this basically says that a bishop is not some kind of, you know, manager, supervisor of the other pastors. Okay, so they rejected this hierarchical Episcopalian view. There were six sitting bishops at that time. They were therefore ordered to enter a pastorate, and not one of them defended their view that, not one of them defended anything besides that. They just were silent. Okay, they also appointed a commission, including Melville and then some of the John Rowe, John Craig, John Erskine, who we mentioned earlier, to consider the policy of the church with respect to the bishops. And there was another sort of impasse between Morton and the church. Okay, he'd ordered his nominee to the Archbishopric of St. Andrews, Patrick Adamson, to not allow himself to be examined by the Kirk. And this was on the grounds that the church hadn't yet set its policy. They had with respect to examining candidates, but I suppose in his favor, I mean, 2 years earlier or a year earlier, he'd asked them to consider what form of government they would abide by, and they hadn't yet answered. So, in any case, they appointed a committee to confer with the regent, and there was this very interesting interchange with between Morton and Melville. We have time for this. Okay, so in this conference, Morton was trying to intimidate the commission in Melville, and we saw that he couldn't do that. He tried to work on his fears by threatening to proceed against him as a disturber of the public peace. And so he one day sent for Melville to his chamber, and after discoursing for some time on the importance of preserving the peace of the church and kingdom, he began to complain that this was in danger of being disturbed by certain persons who sought to introduce their private conceits and foreign laws on points of ecclesiastical government. Melville explained by telling his grace that he and his brethren took the scriptures and not their own fancies or the model of any foreign church for the rule and standard of the discipline which they defended. Morton said that the General Assembly was a convocation of the king's lieges and that it was treasonable for them to meet without his allowance. To this Melville answered that upon such a supposition, Christ and his apostles must have been guilty of treason, for they convocated hundreds and thousands and taught and governed them without asking the permission of magistrates. And yet they were obedient subjects and commanded the people to give what was due unto Caesar. Having appealed in proof of this to the Acts of the Apostles, the regent replied scornfully, "Read ye ever such an act as we did at St. Johnston," referring to the armed resistance which the lords of the congregation made to the Queen Regent at Perth in the beginning of the Reformation. "My lord," answered Melville, "if ye be ashamed of that act, Christ will be ashamed of you." All right, so Morton had been one of the lords of the congregation that participated in this. He added that in a great emergency, the conduct of men was not to be rigidly scanned by common rules, and actions which in ordinary cases would be highly censurable may be excused and even approved, as their Savior did not condemn but virtually justified those who from eagerness to obtain the cure of a palsied invalid broke open the roof of a house to admit him without waiting the permission of the owner. At that time the kingdom of heaven suffered violence and all men pressed into it without asking the leave of the prince or emperor. The regent exclaimed in a tone of menacing irritation, which few who were acquainted with his temper could hear without apprehension, "There will never be quietness in this country till half a dozen of you be hanged or banished the country." "Tush, sir," replied Melville. "Threaten your courtiers after that manner. It is the same to me whether I rot in the air or in the ground. The earth is the Lord's." And there's a little Latin phrase here which we have translated as, "My country is wherever goodness is." "I have been ready to give my life where it would not have been half so well expended at the pleasure of my God. I have lived out of your country 10 years as well as in it. Let God be glorified. It will not be in your power to hang or exile his truth." So I think we have someone else here who doesn't really fear the face of man. But I enjoyed that little interchange. Okay, well, that's all for today. Questions, discussion? Dr. Reese.
This business of officious. What you say is the appointment of officials and this linkage with the king, particularly that a market establishment of the church.
Does it mark the establishment of the Scottish church, you mean?
Yeah. It seems to me that sort of couples together the organization of the church and the organization of the crown.
Yeah, they, they would have maintained that they were the same church, Reformed, as it existed before the Reformation, let alone before, you know, Episcopacy. But I would say this is certainly one of the fundamental, sort of a fundamental sea change for the Scottish, church. I was going to say, it's not as if they were previously in favor of Episcopacy, but it's now becoming more and more well-defined. And this remains a very important issue because James wants to appoint bishop, Charles wants to appoint bishop, all of the kings want to appoint bishops so they can control the church. And so, yes, this is the major thing. And in 1688, it was finally settled, more or less, in favor of Presbyterianism, that the civil magistrate recognized that Presbyterianism was the form of church government. But yeah, this is definitely very important. Even if some defenders of Episcopacy claim that these superintendents were like bishops, those in a Book of Discipline in 1560. But right, if you read the Book of Discipline, it says, you know, very clearly these are interim measures, you know, to you try to keep things going, and you know, it's very clear it's not a permanent system of like bishops only called superintendents. So yeah, they're going to continue. In fact, in another 2 years, they'll put out this second Book of Discipline. It'll be much clearer on the concept of bishops. They reject it. So other than, the name, you know, applies to other, you know, elders. So it's,
It seems quite significant that it's going to battle and basically being appointed by a king.
Right. Right, that, of course, right, our title for the class, The Tale of Two Kingdoms, this is the two kingdoms clashing. You know, the civil magistrate wants to appoint them.
That's effectively what still happens in church,
The queen still appoints the bishops?
Well, no, it's the government, you know, it's the queen's government.
Oh, the queen's government, okay.
But the power of the connection is a very bad connection.
Yeah. Right.
For at least very early on.
The parliament in England is the
government.
Yeah. Yeah, that's. Even though now her government is appointed, quote, by the people, you know, with an election, it's still considered to be her government.
Well, it means that non-Christians are basically controlling Christians.
Yeah.
Well, but again, it's just a minor detail. Well, it's not really, but I think it was always Parliament that officially appointed the bishop in England, and not the crown. But
Well, certainly, I don't know about always, but in this time, when James was king, he was appointing bishops. I mean, that's what he was doing, so.
All right.
Well, we'll look into that, Rob. I mean, it's possible it was officially Parliament, but I think it was actually James. But we'll get to that. It's going to come up, so we'll see for sure who was doing it. Mike.
Wasn't it quite revolutionary then for the American model to take on separation of church and state? I mean, it looks like, was there a model like that in Europe at any point in time that they could draw from? Or was there always this state trying to do the church business, really an attempt to get their hands on the problem?
Well, I suppose there's really two issues. One is, or three issues. We have today the sort of radical separation of church and state. And of course, if you go back to the founding of the country, right, it was only the federal government, which is supposed to be sort of an association of states, but it would be separate from the church. It wouldn't make any laws, right, pertaining to the church. But the state governments, of course, did have. There were state churches, right? So
some of those states, I believe, actually took tax money and gave it to the church.
Right. Yeah, benefices. But so that's sort of the one issue. I mean, even in American government, there wasn't this complete radical separation. I mean, it was somewhat different from that. I guess what would have been. And then if you think about church and state being together, I guess there's really two issues. One is the financial one. Do either taxes support the church, or are there like church property benefices that somehow are supporting the state? That would be one issue. And the other would be sort of an official state, officially recognized state church. And again, the states in our country, the states did have state churches, or at least some of them did. I don't think it was that radical of a change, but from that standpoint. But, you know, I guess perhaps on the other side, the other hand, I mean, it was, the federal government was, separate, so it, maybe, I don't know. I guess it depends how you look at it. Maybe it was more radical change.
Well, the explicit part of the Constitution that said there will be no test votes for anyone running for office. Made for more radical separation of church and state than the laws that everyone seems to look to, that Congress will make no law establishing respecting the establishment of a religion.
Right. Yeah, well, I think long term that had a big effect, didn't it?
Well, it's been more a misreading of that.
No, the test of business.
Right.
The long term, that had no. In the long term, that had a big, major effect. But.
Right. Well, that does establish separation. I mean, that says explicitly that it doesn't matter what you believe, you can run.
Yeah.
Whereas most of the states, that was one of the big faults. That was one of the big parts of how they established their church. They said you have to be Protestant, you have to be Trinitarian, or you have to be, in some states it was even more specific, you have to be this in order to run for office. Right. But I think it was thought that, there was a lot of debate about it. I think to some extent it was thought that I'm not going to read the details, so I'm not going to say this, but the delegates originally came from the states, I think. Anyhow, I need to look into it a lot more. But I think it was thought that the power would be derived from the states, so that would already be handled on the state level. But to some extent, I think that a lot of that was even just lip service. The rationalism had started to take hold. And Lugman had its effect. And if they were somewhat secular in their approach, even though they were outwardly claiming to be Christians, and there were Christians involved as well. But it's hard to read into any kind of monolithic point of view.
I'm just thinking, if we keep going at this pace, it will take about 5 years to get to 1776. I'm not planning on going that long. But what's that? Not me, obviously. Okay, well.
I can have another question.
Okay.
Now that all that's done, James, it's interesting to me that James received at least somewhat of an education. He tried to bring him up in the Christian manner, and he turned out more like his biological mother than
yeah.
environment. I mean, is there any significance to that? Is that just how it happened to be, or?
Well, I think there's lots of significance to that. I mean, it includes things like a good education only goes so far. I mean, if God doesn't regenerate you, you could take your good education and use it to devious ends, which is what James did. Well, now wait a second. That's not exactly true. Buchanan did do that sometimes. But what's that? We have a story that's even better. You're going to love this.
It's one thing for a teacher to do that, though, that you go home and...
Right. Well, in fact, see, this kind of leads into that, if I can find this story here. One afternoon, the head tutor was disturbed by the noise of James and some companions. He had some companions that studied with him in the garden outside. He stamped out to command silence and then returned to settle down again. The noise rose anew. The old man rushed out and the boys fell silent except for James. Putting his hands on his hips, he looked at the tutor boldly and said, "Who'll bell the cat?" A saying famous in Scots history from the reign of James III. Buchanan fell on him at once. James Howells produced the Countess of Mar, as large in her farthingale as an overstuffed bed, bristling with indignation. She gathered the weeping James in her arms and turned to Buchanan. "How dare you," she asked, "how dare you lay your hands on the Lord's anointed?" So I think this kind of gives you this feel for what, you know, even though he did get... So he said, Buchanan, breathing heavily, glared at her in contempt. "I have whipped his arse," he said. "You can kiss it if you like." So then he turned and went back into the library, leaving the bystanders doubled in laughter and a new legend to make the rounds. Yet the incident was clear enough. The king was growing up. So, yeah, I think you're right. Like, you know, he may have been whipped occasionally, but, you know, if that was the attitude, most of the other people around him took, then, of course, you know, what's he going to learn but that everything revolves around him? So.
He should have been more like Merlin. Just drop him off at some lower lord path. Raised him as a squire.
Well, I think there was a reason for that. So, well, let's see. Mike, would you close in prayer?